amigos are we. Brother to brother and everyone, a brave amigo. Fighting for justice and liberty. Wherever you find us is where we will be.
Welcome back. The amigos are riding once more. We are doing one last show for you in the before the 2018-19 hockey season, whether that be NHL, whether that be AHL, OHL, USHL, SHL, around the world, your local Bantam League. We are here to talk hockey. I'm Kirk Ludeke, as you know, joined by my good amigos, Reed Duthie, Dominic Tiano. Boys, welcome. Good to have you guys on once more.
Awesome to be back, boys. Awesome to be back.
Yeah,
well, this is always fun.
We had to honor that contract, right, Dom? You talked about
it.
Reed, why don't you tell the listeners what happened the last time we were doing this? It was kind of crazy. We were in the middle of our second, hour for a pod, and then all of a sudden you had a little bit of Mother Nature intervened.
I believe what ended up happening was it was a lightning strike that took out something down the street from us, and our power went out right in the middle of the broadcast, and everything, my computer and everything that I was working on at the time, shut down.
Yeah.
And everything went black, and I was sitting there, and all I could think to do was text message the two of you guys and say, my power just went out. All I had left was my cell phone.
Yeah.
This almost became a call-in show.
Yeah. Hey, Dom and I tried to soldier on, and we did a little bit more. But at the end of the day, I just felt like, hey, you can't have an amigos show with just two of us. So scrap that. And we thought, with this mailbag idea of Ask the Amigos would be a perfect way to kind of get us, have the listeners who, again, we appreciate the listener support, but have the listeners submit some questions on the blog about hockey and Bruins and whatever, and we'd answer it. So here we are to do that. We did get some questions. A lot of them are Bruins-centric. To those who submitted questions, we appreciate it. I did the best to capture your names. If I didn't get them quite right, you probably know what question you submitted. But we're going to go ahead and get after it and go ahead and answer some of these questions and maybe have a little bit of additional commentary at the end. But again, thank you for listening to our show. And without further ado, the first question comes to us from a reader listener named Brian. And it's pretty short and to the point. And the question is, are the Bruins going to bring in a veteran center on a PTO, professional tryout, for the third line? And so with that, we will flip it over to our good friend Dom and let him take the lead on that. Dom?
Well, I never want to say never, but I highly doubt it. If you look at the list of a handful of guys that are out there, off the top of my head, there's Chris Kelly, who's like 37, 38 years old now. Dominic Moore, who's the same age. Mark Letestu would have probably been interesting, but he signed a PTO with Florida this week. Sean Mathias is another guy. He's 30 years old. He averaged 11, 12 minutes a game last season, but only played in 25, 26 games, I believe. Joel Colburn is out there, our old friend Joel Colburn, former first-round pick, who was traded for Tomas Cabrale way back when, didn't play a single game in the NHL last year. And Antoine Vermette is an interesting name. He's out there. He's 35, 36 years old now. He played in 65 games last year and was averaging 13, 14 minutes a game. I think if they're looking at anybody, he may be the name, but and by the way, he's good friends with Patrice Bergeron. But I just don't see that they're going to be bringing anybody in. Not after they signed Corrali to his deal, and they've got a couple of guys who can play center on the fourth line. I'm just not expecting it to happen.
No, that's great analysis, Dom, and I for the most part agree with you. I do think the one guy that's got a chance to be brought in at this point would be Joe Colburn, just because of the history that he's got with the Bruins, in that he's still a youngish player, still has some room in his game where he could grow in the right situation. But I don't think he would make it over any of the current options that they'll have in the system. Antoine Vermette's the interesting name. Does he get a look based on being friends with Patrice Bergeron? I could go either way on that. But again, he's another player that I think if they bring him in, it's not really doing any service to Antoine himself or to the Bruins, because the options that they're going to have are aplenty for that third line role, and I just don't think he would be the guy to stick in that spot anyway.
Is that kind of like a Simone Gagné, Jay Pandolfo, you know, type? Like, you don't, like, I go back, I remember Antoine Vermette being 2000 draft player, you know, and it just blows my mind it's been 18 years since the 2000 draft, but that's what you, so Dom's right on. You're talking 18 plus 18 equals 36. So, like, I can't believe he's 36.
I just pulled up his stats in front of me here, Kirk. Yeah. He's 36 years old, played in 64 games, 8 goals, 8 assists, minus 5, and averaged 13.44 of ice time per game last season. Now, is Sean Corrali going to be able to top 8 goals, 8 assists if he's playing the third line, give you some solid penalty killing, and play 13 minutes a night? And is what, 16 years younger, or 15 years younger? You know, is Vermette really a better solution in that spot?
Yeah, probably not. Yeah, you know, I think I go back to, I just don't think there's anyone they could bring in on a PTO that's even appreciably better than what they already have. And, you know, it goes back to there always seems to be an interest, and I'm not picking on you, Brian, it was a good question, but there's always like an interest that fans have in adding players from the outside versus trying to stick with what the team already has on hand. And it's like that, hey, you know, we've got a good group of players and prospects that are all vying to make this team, but hey, let's bring in another mediocre player who's past his prime and muddy the water and bring him in and, yeah, give him a shot. Yeah, yeah. You know, again, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. There are a few guys that have done it. I think, I can't recall, was Glenn Metropolit, I think, was one of those guys, right?
Where, yes, yeah.
PTO, yeah. But, you know, I don't think there's a Glenn Metropolit out there this year, you know, in terms of providing that kind of an impact. And that was a different team. When we look back to the 07-08 Bruins, they were just coming off of Peter Chiarelli's first year as GM, and it did not go well. And so it was different circumstances for you know, than now, where we just have a lot more of a cupboard of prospects that are knocking on the door and are probably worth either that, you know, young veterans like Corrali that have gotten in some NHL games, or guys like, you know, Jakob Forsbacka Karlsson. We'll talk about him more, I think, as this podcast goes on. But guys that are just, I think, are going to give you more bang for the buck than, you know, any of the players that are out there. So that's just
exactly.
That's,
you know. And I wasn't suggesting Corrali as the spot is his.
No, no, no. I
got you. He's going to have to earn it. And there are guys, JFK, as you mentioned, Jack Stadnika is another one who are close to knocking on the door. And maybe, you know, one of them steps up and forces Don Sweeney and Coach Cassidy's hand and says, hey, we've got to have this guy in the lineup. So, I just don't see a PTO, not of the guys that are available out there, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Good. All right. Well, hey, thanks, Brian, for the question. We're going to go to Anthony in Cumberland, Maine, next. And he asked, amigos, it looks like Jake DeBrusk is penciled in on David Krejci's left side. What lines do you see Danton Heinen, Ryan Donato, and Anders Bjork making an impact on? So, Dom, let's go ahead and let you take that one as well, since you've got some pretty good thoughts on those players and kind of the Bruins lineup in particular.
Well, First of all, it'd be nice if we could be sit here and discuss Linus. But the truth of the matter is it's the end of August. There's training camp to go through. There's going to be players, like I just mentioned, in JFK and Jack Stanika knocking on the door, although that's probably at the center position. It's who knows? Somebody could come into camp, surprise, force management's hand into giving them a spot. It's hard to say how it's going to pencil in. Personally, if I'm looking at the number one line with Patrice Bergeron and Brad Marchand, if we're talking putting a kid up there instead of David Pastrnak, I like Danton Heinen. I like the way he thinks the game. He's smart. He's not as flashy as David Pastrnak. I think he would probably have the easiest time of fitting in with those guys. That said, they've got to be willing to move David Pastrnak onto David Krejci's line. I like DeBrusk with Krejci. Anders Bjork showed that he could fit in the right wing position early on before his injury, his first injury. Let's let it play out, see where these guys are in camp. None of the three of us have seen them all summer long do anything, so we don't know where they're at. I don't know. I've always been a firm believer in pairs. It's Marchand and Bergeron. It's Krejci and whether it's going to be Pastrnak on the right side or whether it's going to be DeBrusk and somebody else. I've always believed in pairs and finding the third guy that's the right fit for each one. So that's the way I look at building a lineup. But I just can't predict what a lineup is going to look like today.
No, that's a great call, and I'm in the same boat because we really don't know what the lineup's going to look like on opening night. For the players mentioned, I do think that DeBrusk and Krejci have developed really nice chemistry, and I don't really want to see that split up. So that would be, to your point, Dom, the pair that I'm looking for on the second line. So obviously, Marchand and Bergeron as one, DeBrusk and Krejci as two. So there's your open spots. Danton Heinen, I think, would be a nice player to play alongside Bergeron and Marchand, as you said. And again, multiple reasons. The physicality that he brings to the table, not scared to get his nose dirty. He'll get in there and dig the pucks loose for the other two. But he's got that skill element to his game as well. That element would be nice to have alongside them because you don't really see Donato or Bjork bringing that to the mix. For those two guys, I think they could be in competition to see who plays with Krejci and DeBrusk, at least at the beginning, if they don't want to move Pastrnak off that line. Because if Pastrnak stays with Bergeron and Marchand, I actually think you'll see Heinen go to the third line because he and David Backes have played well together at times. So there's a number of levels of the way things could happen, and it could be that Heinen's playing first line or third line. It could be that Ryan Donato is playing first line or third line. It's very tough to get a real sense of it right now, but those are three players in Heinen, Donato, and Bjork who are going to have big roles on this team, and really they have to if the Bruins want to have any success.
Right. Yeah, I think, if there's one guy that's in danger of perhaps maybe seeing some time in Providence, it's Donato, right? And because he's got options. I mean, it would be, he did play very well, and it would be great to have him up. And then again, I go back to what you both have said. This is why we have a preseason. This is why it's nice to sit around and spitball ideas in April and in August and whenever. But the reality is, you have a whole off season of conditioning and things that are going on. You have potentials for guys to get banged up and unforeseen things like trades and things to happen. And so, while it's a nice exercise, I appreciate the question, Anthony. If I had to guess, I could see Anders Bjork and Danton Heinen both on the third line. I think Dom's point about Dan Heinen up on the first line is a good one, because he has produced, like, he's the most productive of the three. Anders Bjork showed a lot of promise and potential early, and then unfortunately was injured and lost for much of the season. You know, so I think he and Donato are the wild cards to an extent, but I also think that Bjork's overall game, his 200-foot game, is a better translation for either the third or the fourth line in Boston versus Ryan Donato, who's kind of a, you know, he's more of a scoring player who I don't know that the details and the refinements are in his game. So he, you know, I could certainly see a Donato potentially seeing some time in Providence to kind of work out the kinks and benefit from more playing time if he's not able to crack the top two lines. But hey, at the end of the day, guys, pretty good problem to have, don't you think?
Yeah, well, sure. And you mentioned wild card, Kirk, and the biggest wild card out there right now is Rick Nash, because I firmly believe if he says tomorrow he's coming back, I firmly believe it'll be with the Bruins. He likes it there. It's just, you know. So if that happens, then we've got another question mark. What do you do then? And it's like we said, let's wait and see. Let it play out. See who does what. Who's knocking at the door? It's just too early to be penciling people in.
Yeah, good. Okay, so Anthony in Cumberland, Maine, thank you for the question. Good stuff. You know, we'll see where it leads. And I know you're probably excited to get the guys into camp. It's hard to believe, but next week the rookies will be, you know, a week from tomorrow, I think we'll be watching the rookies play in Buffalo, which is awesome. And then the veterans won't be too far behind. So this crystal ball, it's cloudy, you know, like if you're looking at the Magic 8 ball, there isn't much, you know, like floating in the pool of knowledge right now. But I'm telling you, it's coming, fans, so just got to hang out. Okay, this next question, we're going to queue it up for Reed, because this is right in his wheelhouse as a former defenseman par excellence in the mold of a Torrey Krug, or for Dom and I, Hoggy Hockey, Greg Hoggood. How about that?
Ah, right? Yeah.
Oh, beauty.
Yeah.
So the question comes from Mike O'Connor. Not sure the hometown, but he provided his full name. Thanks, Mike. Says, hey, guys, with the Bruins looking to go with 8D into the season, do you think this could be a new trend they are doing or trying by giving guys a lot of rest during the season and saving the cost of depth D-men at the trade line, hence the third-round pick for Nick Holden? So kind of an interesting question, because it's talking about trends, but I know you'll find a way to probably creatively answer that and bring up like kind of the way the team is positioned. So over to you, Reed.
Well, thank you very much. And thanks to Mike for the question. It is an interesting setup for this question, because there are multiple levels to this. So let me first go with this idea of the trend and not doing what they did last year for Nick Holden. And I don't think that's evidence of a trend. The reason why they brought Nick Holden in was twofold. One, they've seen what injuries can do in playoff series to their defense core. They've seen it against Ottawa, and they saw it again last year against the Tampa Bay Lightning. So they felt that Nick Holden would be able to help the team, not just as a depth player, but as somebody who you could regularly have in the top six. Now, unfortunately for Nick Holden, he didn't quite mesh the way that they were hoping when they brought him over, and I think they're going to do a lot better with John Moore coming in. He seems to be more of a fit for the way that Bruce Cassidy wants to play. So I think there is a bit of a trend in that they are going to want to be able to have eight NHL-ready defensemen, so that if anything happens during the season, you do have guys available to you quickly who can jump right in. But there's also an argument where you could say the Bruins have far more than eight NHL-ready defensemen, because Jakob Zboril and Urho Vakanainen could step into the lineup very, very quickly, and I don't think it would take a lot for either one of them to acclimate themselves to the next level. So it is a trend, but if you have a strong pipeline, you don't necessarily have to have eight quote-unquote NHL defensemen in the immediate. So trend, yes. Is it going to be this way all along? Probably not. When you look at the Bruins' defense and how it shapes up overall, I think there are six names that obviously stand out, and it's the bottom four that are going to be in and out. When I'm talking bottom four, I'm talking five, six, seven, and eight. So you figure right now, if the season started tonight, Matt Grizzlick and Adam McQuaid would likely be the two that find themselves in the press box, because when you get past that, if everybody's healthy, you have the pair of Char and McAvoy, which we've seen with chemistry. They play very well off of one another. Brandon Carlo and Torey Krug, it took them a little bit of time to get things going as a pair, but once they did, they had that same element that McAvoy and Char did, the bigger defensive defenseman holding things down and letting Torey Krug kind of explode up the ice a little bit more. And then you can go with a very strong third pair of John Moore and Kevin Miller, which could be a real sleeper third pair for the Bruins that when we get down the road further into the season, we could be looking back and going, wow, that move for John Moore made a huge difference. So they are very deep in the back end. I still think there may be a move here, though, guys, with a defenseman at some point, because having eight salaries against the cap all on that back line when two of them aren't going to be able to play every night, that may burn the Bruins a little bit in the front office.
I just want to touch on or say something about John Moore, because Reed brought him up. I was listening to NHL radio last week, or maybe 2 weeks ago, and they had some NHL people. I don't like to use the word experts, but these are professionals that do this for a living. And they were talking about the most impactful acquisitions on July 1st. And the list went, and I remember the top four, and that's all I remember. Number one was John Tavares. Number two was James Neal. Number three was Ryan O'Reilly. And number four was John Moore.
Yeah, that's high praise. It shows exactly what the Bruins were looking for in that acquisition, because he is everything that the Bruins were looking for last year at the trade deadline that they just couldn't quite get. And now you've got the big size, that frame on John Moore at 6'2", 210 plus, with that kind of mobility. When you watch highlights of John Moore, and granted, highlights are put together to show the best of a player, but when you see him striding up the ice, he skates like someone much smaller than he is, and that's a great sign for somebody with that kind of frame.
Exactly. You know, I wasn't expecting to hear his name there. I thought it was probably going to be further down the list, but a lot of people are undervaluing him and what he's going to mean to this team. The cap issues that you raised, Reed, I'm a firm believer that you can fix the cap issues at another date. If it's going to hinder you, like you said, if the Zboril or Backenainen are knocking at the door, maybe to consider moving one, you know, just before the Christmas roster freeze or something. But the cap isn't something that should be a concern, because the Bruins have showed that they can deal with the cap, they can fix the cap, and I've got all the faith in the world that they can do that.
Yeah, interesting. You know, I don't think it's a trend, the number of D. You know, I think it's a product of quality, depth, and it's a timeline in the organization that, you know, perhaps gives them the confidence to open a window of opportunity to these players. But I think you're right, Reed. I'd be surprised if they stick with 8D for an extended period of time, because this is, again, as we've said, you know, a kind of recurring theme on this podcast, this is why we have your preseason and your exhibition schedule. It's to see, you know, who's going to establish themselves and, you know, who's going to maybe get hurt and open an opportunity for someone else, who's going to underperform and maybe end up being on the block to be moved down or out of the organization. And I think, you know, trying to make sense of the moves by drawing lines, you know, for cause and effect, like the Nick Holden point, I'm just not sure about that. I think we have to remember, you know, the Bruins drafted 10 players in 2015. They had a couple first rounders in 2016. You know, they've had extra picks and prospects that are kind of percolating. And at some point, those bills are going to come due in terms of, you know, so they're facing, you know, Don Sweeney's facing a ticking clock in terms of trying to, you know, some of these players are signed and on their entry-level deals, so he's going to kind of have to see what they're capable of. And I would be highly surprised if the GM and his staff is sitting around saying, you know, hey, let's develop a deliberate process to have extra guys on our roster so we can rest guys and then we don't have to make trades at the deadline. I mean, I don't think that's how it typically works. You know, GMs will make the moves they feel will help the team, and whether that's by calling up players in-house from the AHL or going out and bringing in talent externally via trade or free agencies, I mean, you know, you're not coming up with an artificial scenario to abrogate the mechanisms that you use to change the roster. I mean, trades happen oftentimes because a GM will call you and say, hey, this player is available. And then, you know, the GM is reaching out to his staff saying, hey, can this guy help us? You know, what do we think? You know, what are we willing to give up? You know, that it doesn't just happen in a vacuum where, hey, we've got eight guys, and so by having these eight guys, it's going to prevent us from having to make trades, you know. And I 100% agree with your point at the beginning, Reed, about why Nick Holden was acquired. Sweeney did not want to be in another situation like he was in 2017. Full stop, period, end of story. And in this case, the worst scenario didn't come to fruition, but unfortunately, you know, the Bruins gave up a third rounder in the process for a player they didn't use very much. And like you said, he just never really clicked.
Yeah, it was unfortunate. I like Nick Holden as a player, and I thought he had the ability to fit in with the team. And he certainly could have maybe given a longer stretch, maybe given more ice time, it would have worked. But just the situation that he was in, he was kind of forced into a couple of spots where he had been out of the lineup and then had to come in and sort of parachute in as an emergency replacement. And that's so tough as a defenseman. It's a hard position to play to begin with. And then just to get parachuted in and, okay, you're lining up next to a guy you've never played with before, and you're going to have to match up on the road against the team's second line. Have fun. Like, that's a tough ask.
Yeah. You know, more is not always more. You know, we talk about this a lot. I know, you know, anytime the draft rolls around, you know, fans get excited and they want their team to have picks, and you know, I get it. When you're sitting there in the third round and you don't have a pick, you know, first round, like, this was a tough draft, this past one, because they didn't have a first rounder, they didn't have a third rounder, at least their own third round. They did have the third rounder they picked up for Frank Vatrano, very good, you know, great pickup, and Jakub Lauko. But you know, that's going to happen, and what I would, you know, the point I try to make to people when I get asked these questions or I have interactions is, you know, your team's not going to be able to draft 10 players every year. These teams that go 11, 12, you know, picks sometimes and get all those prospects, at some point they have to flush, they have to give away picks because they can't have so many prospects in their organization because not all of them are going to be able to play, right?
And that's something the three of us have been preaching since 2015,
right,
as well, Kirk, that all these guys, they're not going to be able to fit all these guys on the club in the window that,
right,
that they need. So moving draft picks, you know, is a necessary evil sometimes.
And they go in cycles. I mean, you know, you have a draft like this last one where they had five players taken, right? And maybe in a couple years when things are shaking out a little more and the Bruins say, hey, hold on, you know, our cupboard's starting to look a little bare. We don't have as much depth. You know, then maybe, you know, Don Sweeney's selling off assets and getting more picks. But like I said, the point I would make to the folks that are listening is more is not often more. You know, you don't, you know, and I know they're sometimes it seems counterintuitive. Oh, no, you got to keep those picks. And that's how you keep your organization strong. Yes. But also understand that different players on different timelines are going to force the hand. And so, you know, going back to the 2015 draft, for example, an inordinate amount of those picks came out of the CHL that year. Major Junior, which is a more accelerated timeline versus those USHL and those college-bound guys, which allow teams to take a longer approach. Some players might play an extra year of junior after they've been drafted and then go to college. And, you know, so, you know, it's a juggling act. And I think sometimes people just look at it in a linear, you know, linear fashion. Okay, we don't have these picks. The team is screwed up. You know, we got to make sure we keep these picks. And look, I don't disagree. This next year is looking like it's going to be a deep draft. So I don't, you know, the Bruins have already, I think, given up they've given up a fifth rounder and a seventh rounder, if I'm not mistaken. I think they've traded a couple of the picks from this draft coming up, if I'm not mistaken. I don't have my my grid in front of me. So, but I don't think you're going to see too many more draft trades with this impressive 2019 group of players. But we'll see how it goes, I guess.
Yeah, and I'm just pulling it up here. They traded the 4th and the 7th for next year already, for 2019. Yeah.
So there you go. But hey, look, you got your first, your second, your third. I think they're going to want to hold on to those. And again, you know what? If they do what we think they'll do, those will be late picks in the round, and I'm totally okay with that. I would be even better if they're 31. Let's just call a spade here, right? All right, boys. Okay, so thank you, Mike. Good question. I think that was probably a very fruitful discussion we had. Great points, Reed and Dom. Next question is from Dave. I think it's Dave in Middleborough, if I'm not mistaken. He said, the Bruins have hoping you can share any insight in whether or not Coco, Alexander Hoklachov, will ever see the light of day in Boston, and where you see him ranked in the depth chart of prospects today. So, Hoklachov is back on the radar. Take it away, guys.
Well, I can give you a rating pretty quick. I think right now, in terms of Bruins prospects, he ranks somewhere between Cameron Mann and Ivan Hummel.
I think Kmart and Bradley's will make a comeback in Boston before we see Coco wearing a spoked bee. That's just me.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat, Kirk. I don't see it happening. He went to the KHL very upset with how he felt he was treated in Boston. Rightly or wrongly, he took off and essentially packed it in on the Bruins, and that's fine. That was his decision. But now all of a sudden this discussion that, well, because Bruce Cassidy is the head coach and he liked him in Providence, he wants to come back. How's he going to feel if Bruce Cassidy turns and says to him, well, kid, you're starting on the third line or you're headed back to Providence to sharpen up a little bit. I think it's going to be the same story all over again. I don't think we're going to see Alexander Kokolchev in Boston.
Look, we all saw the discussion that, you know, he talked to the Bruins back, or the Bruins actually sent somebody in Russia back in January to see him and talk to him. I didn't believe then, and I don't believe now, that he had any intention of coming back to Boston. And you guys may remember a tweet I made when somebody asked me about Coco, and I had a picture of him in a Bruins uniform with his name down there, Kokolchev, with the KHL in his name in bright red letters. Look, people say he didn't get a fair shake in Boston. You know what? You can play in the AHL and put up 70, 80, 90 points, whatever you want. And it shows maybe your offensive side of the game. What he wasn't doing is picking up the aspects of the game that the Bruins wanted him to. And when he got his shot in Boston, he looked terrible. It's not that he wasn't given a chance. He just didn't show what they needed him to show in the AHL. Case in point, his first year in the KHL was terrible. So if he couldn't do it in the KHL, he couldn't do it in Boston. If he comes back to North America, I don't think it's going to be in a Bruins uniform. Where's he going to fit? You got Patrice Bergeron. You got David Krejci. You got JFK ahead of him. You got Jack Stanika ahead of him. You got Sean Corrali ahead of him. The list goes on and on. He's just not a fit.
Yeah, you know what? The Bruins have a multitude of quality prospects up front, and I'm all for focusing on them rather than looking at a player who, you know, while talented, and look, we were excited about him, second-round pick in 2011 after the Stanley Cup championship. I mean, look, that's not to diminish. It was a good shot to take, right? But he wasn't the kind of Bruin-type player. You know, he was kind of an anomaly. One, he was Russian, and they had not taken many Russians in a while. And they continue to still just, you know, that the team doesn't have a great track record with Russian players compared to other teams. And then I just don't think he ever skated well enough to be what the Bruins needed him to be. You know, he was, you know, loved the hands and the creativity offensively, but I don't think that, you know, given his size, it just wasn't a dynamic enough skater. And I think that hurt him. And so if he couldn't develop the details, what you were talking about, Dom, the details in his game of what Claude Julien demanded of the players in the lineup, especially where he was going to have to play, you know, it just wasn't going to happen for him. So I think at this point, you know, move on. We got to move on. Coco, maybe he makes a comeback. I think the Bruins were smart to retain his rights because it means they can get something for him. But I would be very surprised if they, the Bruins, or even Coco, for that matter, would want to make a second tour with this team work. I think it's water under the bridge, and there's a lot of other great prospects out there. And, you know, let's focus on them. That's just my two cents.
Agreed.
All right.
Totally.
Okay. So moving on to the next question. From Ray, it's, he posted an incredibly thorough and probably exhausting statistical analysis of Rask was recently done by C. Beswick. I know he's the best the Bruins have. This is Rask. But what do you think the Bruins should do long term about the goalie situation?
Kirk, I'm going to go back to the 2015 draft. You were at that draft. And while you were texting me, I was texting you at the same time after the Bruins had traded Dougie Hamilton and Milan Lucic. And we were texting each other at the same time, Rask is next. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. I had a tip, and you had a tip, and it was looking like it was going to happen. What happened?
And I think my personal take is the Bruins felt the backlash in the Hamilton trade and the Lucic trade that they thought it would be a PR disaster to move to Carrasque. Now, that being said, we've talked about Tuukka Rask plenty on these podcasts. I believe we went into great detail in it on the last one, so I won't rehash all that. But the thing about Tuukka Rask is when he's on his game, he's on his game. And the best thing that could have happened to him right now is the Bruins bringing Yaroslav Halak in, who I think is going to push Tuukka to be at his best. That said, would I have, looking back now, I wouldn't have traded him. He, especially if you look at the season he had last year, he was a beast there going, what was it, 20-some-odd games undefeated. And, you know, he's going to have to carry this team for a few more years because the prospect pool is there. We don't know what's going to happen with Zane McIntyre, you know, in the next month and a half or so, because there's no room for him on the NHL roster. He's going to have to go on waivers to go down to the AHL. We know Swayman's got a couple of years at the NCAA remaining. Vladash, you know, if McIntyre is in Providence, how much time is he going to get playing in Providence? To me, the sleeper, and Reed, you're going to have my back on this one, I know you will, is Kyle Kizer.
Oh, yeah.
I am shocked that he wasn't drafted two years ago and the Bruins were able to get him as an undrafted free agent. You know, he had a tremendous season last year after he completely recovered from his concussions. He was at Team USA's summer camp for the upcoming World Juniors this year. I think he's got a really good shot of making that squad.
And what's the most important thing about Kyle Kizer, Dom?
The most important thing about Kyle Kizer.
I know where he's going.
I'm not sure where he's going. Where are you going with this, Kirk?
Take it away, Reed.
He's an Oshawa General.
Yeah!
Oh, yeah.
Baby!
Yeah, he's an Oshawa General. For those that don't know, Oshawa is Kirk's team. I put him in the same bolt as guy Kirk's or Reed sees every night is Caden Fulcher, another guy who went undrafted and signed 5 minutes after Kyle Kizer signed with the Detroit Red Wings. These two guys are going to come into the NHL and I think surprise a lot of people. So to me, Kizer's the sleeper in it. Has he got the potential to be a number one NHL goaltender? I think he could be a good 1B, or he could be a very, very good backup, an excellent backup. Whether he's that, I don't think he'll be that elite number one goaltender for a team, but he's got some good upside. So
I have a much simple answer. Okay. You ready? Ready? Keep drafting and developing quality players at the position. That's it, right? So you just named off a bunch of really good options, right? Some of them were drafted. You know, one of them was signed, or most of them were drafted. One of them was signed, not drafted, but he came in, got an opportunity, played well. They signed him to a contract. I guess they could potentially trade, for a younger, promising goalie caught in a numbers game, much like they did 12 years ago to get Tuukka Rask. But look, I mean, like you said, Zane McIntyre, like right now you've got Halak and Rask. Those are your goalies. You know, the only way Zane McIntyre is going to get an opportunity is if someone gets hurt. And like you said, someone could pluck Zane. Great guy, wish him the best, but you know, the longer it goes, I don't know that he has that number one projection, but, you know, you never say never. And then those other guys you mentioned, you know, whether it's Swayman, Ladosh, Kizer, you just have to continue to draft and develop your players or trade for guys and keep the window open that if things go south, you have options. But, you know, it's a pretty critical position, so... beyond that, I mean, I don't know what they do. You know, you typically don't see number one goalies get traded very often. So, it's going to be a challenge for sure. Reed, what do you think?
I tend to agree that they just need to keep going on the same road they're going and bringing in these intriguing prospects that can project out long term and be of help to the organization down the road. For Tuukka Rask, the biggest thing for him was bringing in Yaroslav Halak, because his best seasons come when he plays in and around that 54 to 58 game mark. When they push him into the mid-60s and up to 70, we've seen his goals against come up and we've seen his save percentage fall. So I think this year with Yaroslav Halak with him, that gives him a chance to really excel and have another really strong season with a very solid back who's fully capable of coming in and winning games. That long-term group, I believe they are still going to add to that goaltending prospect pool. Kizer is very intriguing. You could see him easily becoming a very, very good backup, if not a 1B. Swayman and Vladosh, I haven't seen a ton of film on them. I know both have intriguing talent levels for the NHL level. It's just a matter of time developing them through. And then who knows, maybe you do stumble into somebody in the draft or stumble into a trade where a team just has to get rid of somebody and all of a sudden you find yourself overflowing with Sulk.
Connor Hellebuck, prospects. Odessa Jackalopes, right? Connor Hellebuck, Odessa Jackalopes,
exactly.
North American League. Never played in the USHL, goes to UMass Lowell, tears it up. You know, Winnipeg Jets struck absolute gold there. You know, you don't have to go and spend a top pick on a goalie. Look, I am happy for Malcolm Subban, doing what he did with Vegas. Boy, you know, he sure would look nice in this discussion, but hey, you know, that's life. That's the way the cookie crumbles. And, just wanted to throw
and don't for, a don't forget, there. There's an expansion draft coming up too. So like you said, you might just be able to pluck one at some point.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and that's where the scouts are so important. I mean, again, you know, Andrew Raycroft, to Toronto for Tuukka Rask, even Steven, you know, not even a bag of peanuts included. Look, that was a heck of a trade. And, you know, those moves are out there to be made. You just right now, Rask is the guy, and Halak is certainly positioned to get, you know, for them to be a good duo tandem, probably the likes of which we honestly haven't seen in Boston since Andy Moog and Reggie Lemelin. I would love to see that.
Yeah, I love that duo. Reggie and Andy,
All right. Well, here is
the guys I grew up on.
Here is a, no doubt. Here's a question for Dom. Jack Studnicka seems to be a value pick where they got him. Before the Bruins took Urho Vaakanainen, I was looking for them to take Ryan Poehling. Living in Montreal, I'd love to know if, in your opinions, the Bruins got a better prospect in the second round with Studnicka than Montreal got with Poehling in the first. That is from Mark in Montreal. I hope he's wearing his flak vest and helmet, because being a Bruins fan in Montreal, you know, that's definitely, you know, that is definitely a danger pay all the way. So, Dom, what do you think?
The easy and quick answer that I have is it's too soon to tell. Now, who knows what kind of careers they go on to have. That being said, you know, I'm a huge fan of Jack Studnicka's. I love the way he plays the game. I love the way he thinks the game. He's one of the smartest guys out on the ice. Full of character, full of leadership. Despite his size, he'll be one of the first guys in there to defend a teammate. He loves his teammates love him, and he can play the game any which way you want to. You know, if I'm being biased, I'd say, yeah, the Bruins did better, but if I'm being honest with myself, it's a too soon to call thing when we're talking guys that, you know, haven't played in the NHL yet. So, you know, the book is still open on that one.
There is every reason to be able to think that, yes, the Bruins did get a better prospect in Jack Studnicka. And I say that as having someone, as being someone who has called him multiple times and has seen him take over games live and in person, watching this kid just run the ice. He is a tremendous prospect, and he really, and I don't use this name lightly, but he does have a lot of Patrice Bergeron to his game. Ryan Poehling is going to be a very solid player for the Montreal Canadiens, but when you look at where the two organizations are, so take away just comparing prospect to prospect, when you look at where the two organizations are, who Jack Studnicka is going to be able to learn from, who Jack Studnicka is going to be able to play with and get ice time with, there's every reason to believe he can be the better prospect, because he has a lot of other things going for him that Ryan Poehling right now with the Habs just doesn't.
Awesome. And that's a fair point, Reed. Fair point.
Fair point. I'm going to be I'm going to take a slightly different tack on this, and I'm going to go back to 2003, because there's always, I think there's that tendency, and since our friend Mark is from Montreal, I have a Montreal-Boston head-to-head comparison, and why that this, you know, this stuff, like, you know, I tend to fall on the side of Dom where it's too early to tell. But in 2003, Montreal had the 40th pick. The Bruins had the 45th pick. Montreal drafted a kid who played for the Montreal Rocket of the Quebec Junior League named Corey Urquhart. He had 78 points. That team later moved to Prince Edward Island, and then I think they folded or they moved somewhere else. I don't know. They're not the Rocket anymore. Maybe they're the Armada. I don't know. Kind of lost the bubble on that. But Urquhart was taken 40th, and then the Bruins at 45 drafted another kid out of the Quebec Junior Hockey League named Patrice Bergeron. Now, Bergeron only had 73 points. Urquhart was like 6'3", 200 pounds. Patrice Bergeron was only, at the time, like 5'10", 170, 180, you know. I remember, you know, just a lot of crowing online about how Urquhart was just going to be awesome, and not a lot of people had time for the Bergeron kid. So fast forward 15 years later, and we've got, for the guy taken at 45, 963 games in the NHL, 289 goals, 734 points, Stanley Cup, Olympic gold medals, plural, World Junior Championship, World Men's Championship, winner in every sense of the word, future Hall of Famer.
Hall of Famer.
Corey Urquhart, to quote Dean Wormer from Animal House, number of NHL games, 0.0. Okay? So my point in all this is the debate will eventually be settled. We'll see. I like both players, but I think that, you know, like, trying to make a contest over who got the better player, like, you know, let's just see him. Let's just see what happens. Let's let him go head to head. And that's, for me, that's the part of the fun of it, is just seeing what they do. I love Studnicka. I love, like, I think to me, he screams Bruin all the way. I think Poehling would have as well. I think there's more pressure on Poehling because he's a first rounder versus Studnicka. But I think both are going to play in the NHL, and in 15 years, maybe we'll have the same kind of debate. And, you know, if you're a Bruins fan, I bet you're hoping that it goes in similar fashion. Bergeron has just been, you know, a Hall of Famer. His 37 will hang from the rafters in Boston Garden one day. I firmly believe that. He is Mr. Bruin. He is to me probably what Milt Schmidt was to fans in the 40s and 50s. I think he will always be a Bruin, and this has been very exciting. And that to me was a great. That was one example I could pull out on. If you had the debate in 2003, you know, a lot of the Montreal folks were probably feeling pretty confident that they had the better player, and it hasn't been close. So we'll just have to see how it goes.
And I'll just add one thing. I will make a prediction. I normally don't make predictions. But Jack Studnicka, we know he can put up points. Jack Studnicka will represent Team Canada at the World Junior Championships, and he will be brought in for a shutdown role. And that speaks volumes to his two-way game.
Yeah, no, after watching what he did in the World Junior Showcase, you know, I think absolutely. And I was excited at seeing what Noah Cates did for Team USA, because Noah Cates was an Omaha Lancer last year. Tremendous. I mean, Philadelphia Flyers got just a tremendous player. But loved watching the World Junior Showcase, because I think you saw some players really emerge as guys that are going to be heard from and are going to be in that tournament. And Studnicka, certainly one of them. And I was just glad that Noah Cates was able to go in there and have the success he did. Good stuff there. Here is a question interesting, because it's going to call for kind of our feel for the game and our ability to evaluate. And it comes from Kevin in Holliston, Mass. It says, "Hi, guys. Love the insight and greatly appreciate it." Well, thank you, Kevin. Glad you like the Amigos and glad you like the blog. So then he goes, simple question. Well, not exactly. Let's break this out here. He says, "As a scout, what factors do you look for when seeing if a winger can play his offside, i.e. left-hand shot playing the right wing, vice versa?" Yeah, we got it, Kevin. Thanks. I ask because the Bruins have a plethora of prospects, young players, who are left-shot wingers, Donato, Bjork, Heinen, Solarik, DeBrusk, and Gabriel, among others. If Sinishin is still a year away, one of those guys is going to get a look on the right side. What do you look for when seeing if a guy can play his off-wing, and which prospects seem like they can play their off-wing, and which ones do you think are less suited to doing so?" I love the word. I love that he used plethora, because we are the Three Amigos, and you may remember that El Wapo asked the question of the Three Amigos if they thought he had a plethora of something. So anyway, I throw that out there. Worthless pop culture reference, but Dom, this question's in your wheelhouse, so go.
Well, that's not an easy question to answer. To me, a lot goes into it. First and foremost, for a player to play on his offside, has to be a very good skater, because depending on the type of defense the team plays, how far back they want the wingers to come, they have to be smart, they have to be able to anticipate, and they have to be able to skate. And the reason why is because a lot of times in the D zone, they're playing with their back towards oncoming players. So, you know, if he's facing the play, he's usually facing his backboards or end boards. So he's got to be able to get out of that situation, think quickly, move quickly, and avoid getting basically plastered and turning the puck over for a chance going your other way. Heading out of the zone, he's got to be able to pass with a backhand. I mean, I've seen kids who can make saucer passes 80 feet rink wide on the backhand, and I've seen guys that can't get it 5 feet in front of them and basically hurt their team because they're playing the offside. It's easy for a right-handed shot heading down the right boards out of the zone to make that pass on the forehand. It's hard for a left-handed shot to make the same play.
Right, and he's also got to be able to catch the breakout pass too.
Yeah,
that's where the trust comes in, right? Because if the defender hits him with the breakout pass and he's got to catch it on his backhand, that's harder, obviously, than if it's on your tape on your forehand. And then you've got a situation where you're potentially causing a turnover in your own end if you don't handle it cleanly. I'm with you 100%. The hands, the skating, the hands, and then the trust factor for coaches, right?
Yeah, and the ability to think in a split second. What am I going to do as the puck's on its way? The good guys usually know what they're going to do, and that's the biggest thing I look for. To me, if we're talking Bjork, we're talking Heinen, you know, we're talking Donato, to me, Danton Heinen fits that role above the other guys.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, in the offensive zone, a major advantage to playing your the off wing is, you know, your stick's in the middle of the ice, you know, on your off wing. So if you're a right-hand shot playing on the left, you know, you're over, your stick's to the middle of the ice versus if you, you know, if you were on the right side where you're up against the wall, right? So you have more options in terms of shooting and passing. So, you know, if you're a skater and you've got the hands now, all of a sudden having your stick in the middle of the ice allows you to adjust your shooting angle. You can make that pass to the middle of the ice because, again, you know, hockey, a lot of the battles are won in the middle of the ice, you know, below the dots, between the hash marks, but the middle of the ice, right, in between those dots and the circles. And so if your stick's over closer to the wall, you're now trying to come from the perimeter in, whereas when you're playing your off wing, your stick's already got the puck cocked into the middle of the ice, and you have a lot more options. And I think that's why when you look at some of the great off wings, you know, Jaromir Jagr, Ilya Kovalchuk, Alexander Ovechkin, certainly, I think those guys are all off wing players, and you see it in the offensive zone for sure as well.
Oh, definitely. But you know, coaches nowadays, they worry about the D zone maybe more than they should, but they've got to be able to protect the D zone first. And you know, that's where I focus my attention.
Yeah.
The guys that have the great shots, and I mean, we see it with David Pastrnak and Brad Marchand a lot, is they'll switch sides to get into that strong position in the O zone that you talk about. But they never do it in the defensive zone. So smart players like those two, they'll be able to shift back and forth in the O zone. But in the D zone, they, you know, they don't go to their weak side because they have better options there.
Yeah. And it's trust. You know, and that gets back to the D zone, right? That who will decide whether a player's, you know, playing on his off wing? The coach, right? The coach,
right.
The coach determines, okay, I'm going to play you, you know, on the off wing, knowing full well you are at a potential disadvantage. Therefore, you have to exhibit trust. Reed, I've left you out of the conversation. Let's get you in here. What do you think?
Well, to me, guys, this is one thing that I always look at when you see players who coaches tell you, okay, well, he's going to come in and we're going to try him on his offside. The first thing I look for, and it sounds so simple, but right away you can tell if a player can do it or not, is just frankly, does he look comfortable? When the puck comes up the boards and he's got to be able to turn his back to the play to be able to do something with it, to be able to make a play, especially in his own zone, as you guys were talking about, when he's got to turn his back, does he look comfortable? Does he look like he's going to panic? Does he look like he's going to get jittery with the puck on his stick and just try to get it as quickly out, and he doesn't care where? Is he going to be able to take that breath and still be able to create, still be able to do everything that he should be doing just on the opposite side of the ice? There are some guys who, when you put them on the offside, they excel, and immediately you can tell they're the kind of guy that can play that role. And there are some guys that when you try them on the offside, and it's the same as sometimes when you try a winger who's shown an aptitude for faceoffs in at a center position, looks completely out of place, that when you try to switch a winger to his offside, looks completely out of place. So it's a lot harder than you would think that it is to just go from one side of the ice to the other, because all of your fundamentals completely change.
So we're looking at skating, we're looking at hands, we're looking at comfort, you know, just and a lot of that, you know, again, you have to be a smart, instinctive player. You've got to be able to sense backside pressure very well. You've got to understand time and space. And so that means, you know, you have to be able to assess the ice when you're facing the play, and then when you turn your back, you have to just have that kind of instinctive, that instinctive feel for, okay, I'm gonna get caved in here if I hold this puck too long. But where do I have lanes and where do I have options? You know, if I hold it, can I protect it? Can I move it to the right spot? And I'm not just going to rim it, you know, like you were saying, Reed, in a panic and try to get rid of it. But I'm going to try to actually make a play to create a breakout and a transition down onto, you know, on offense. And that is, you know, it's fundamental to the game, but it's easier, a lot easier said than done. It's easy to talk about, much harder to execute it. Bottom line is, you have to have certain attributes, and I think you guys, you know, certainly covered it pretty well. I mean, there's a lot more probably that goes into it, but you know, at the end of the day, you know, playing your off wing, you know, not everyone can do it. It's just like some guys can play, you know, can move around and play all three forward positions. They can play center, they can play their natural, you know, their natural side wing, their strong side wing, or they can move to the off. Not everyone can do that. It's the same kind of thing, and that I think the onus goes on the coaches to determine, you know, who is best suited to do that if they have an overload of left shots versus right, and they have to figure out, you know, who's going to work. And the bottom line, they'll find that out, but you know, typically before we get to the games, you know, they're finding that out in training camp and the practices and the drills. And determining, okay, you know, who's going to do that versus, you know, just winging a prayer and, well, just throw this guy out there and see if he can handle it, right?
Oh, definitely. A lot of thought and a lot of observing goes into it. You just can't pick a name out of a hat out of three or four guys and say, this is the guy that we're going to try there. A lot of thought process goes into the decision.
Yeah, and that's, you know, and your point about the, you know, being able to make the you know, pass from both side of your blade, like, that's a key component in the scouting reports that I tend to do. Like, if I see a guy that can do that, I make a note of it. Because it isn't, you know, all players are not universal and equal in terms of their ability, and that's a classic example. You know, a player, you know, most players at the higher levels, as they climb the ladder, they can make that forehand pass. And you know, I've been in situations where coaches will tell players, hey, listen, you know, when you have the puck, especially if you're on a, you know, killing a penalty, you're in your zone, it's late in the game, you're protecting the lead, make that extra move to get the puck off your backhand to your forehand if possible. Because making that forehand play is a higher percentage pass every time, right? Even if you're very good on the backhand. You know what I mean?
I'll tell you, the best guy I ever seen do it in junior, and I'm going to shock a lot of people with this, never made it to the NHL, you know, and I've seen some great ones in junior, Connor McDavid on down, is Jared Knight. The guy had an unbelievable backhand pass. He could fire it 80 feet. Cross ice, saucer it all on the backhand.
Yeah.
Never played a game in the NHL.
Not surprising. Unfortunately, you know, being an NHL player is—it's a very select company of hockey players, and there are some great, you know, some really accomplished players that have come close and been accomplished at different levels, you know, and just never were able to make it to the top. And you know, that's kind of an interesting lead into the next question, I think, which comes from DeFumi, who's a bit of a celebrity there on HF boards. Hey, DeFumi, good videos on YouTube. Appreciate it. He's a David Krejci guy too, if I'm not mistaken. He writes, do you think the trend towards developing younger players at the NHL level has had any drawbacks? Does the need to produce sooner and play in a more rigid system limit growth or lead to poor fundamentals? So that's a good question, DeFumi. I'm gonna take this one. You know, I think to answer the question, you've got to kind of look at the evolution of hockey and change from what used to be, you know, a seasonal sport where, you know, hockey players did other things in the spring and summer months versus the year-round endeavor it is now, because the ice just wasn't available and times were different. You know, these days, if you're a player who aspires to reach the NHL, you can't take the summer off. You know, you're going to be doing something hockey related. You're going to be skating, you're going to be developing your skills, or you're going to be maybe on a summer team, you know, and playing in a lot of tournaments, and you really don't have an off season. And I think the debate that comes in is whether players are better off focusing on those individual skills development versus playing on summer teams and not getting as much practice and skills development, you know. But I think that paradigm shift is what has created younger players at the NHL level, because I just go back to when I was younger and just the general skill level and ability of players was less at the ages of 16, 18, you know, 30 years ago. I was in high school. I'm the middle guy here. Dom, you're our veteran, our
elder statesman. Yeah.
There you go. I was going to, you know, throw that, you know. But and then Reed, you're the baby of the group. But 30 years ago, I was in high school. And when I look at the USHL players, for example, that we have in Omaha or around the league, it's stunning to me just how advanced these players are at that age compared to the guys I remember. And it's night and day. And I think it's a reflection of opportunities that dedicated and talented players have to get better and to specialize in the sport of hockey year-round. And so I don't know that the overall picture limits growth or directly correlates to poor fundamentals. I think it's reflective of the opportunities in the environments that these players are in as they develop. One thing that certain players can't control is, you know, the kind of program they're in, the quality and the coaching they're going to get. You know, some players are going to get former pro coaches that get it and are teach them the game at an early age, and they're able to thrive because they have different opportunities than others that maybe don't have advanced coaching. And so at some point, if they might have the physical talent and the ability to be pros, but if they don't get that coaching, it's going to be a steeper learning curve for them, you know, things like that. And again, we're just going to scratch the surface with this question because it requires a lot of depth and thought. But I don't think the trend will ever change now, like in terms of the NHL getting younger, you know, having younger players. They're going to continue to embrace, you know, young, skilled players just simply because, you know, youngsters are able to fast track their development so much more on and off the ice compared to how it used to be, and where you needed more time to develop. You didn't have as much time, and so you needed more time, and it was an older league and all of that. So I think you'll always have your early risers and late bloomers, but in the end, the sport's growth globally means that there's going to continue to be an active pipeline from the amateur to the pro ranks, and it's the process of getting there that will be an ongoing source of debate and contention. So I don't think it's more about a rigid system limiting growth or leading to poor fundamentals. It's about maybe trying to share best practices as much as possible so that those guys, those players that aren't in traditional programs or may not have as good a coaching or as good opportunities, maybe get those. But great question, and I'm going to open it up to you guys.
Well, I think, guys, that we're seeing a situation where the only drawback that I really see to it is that with the need to produce so quickly in the NHL level, that
you're looking at a system where guys can get passed over and moved on from too quickly. And I think maybe at times you need to sort of take a step back and realize before you give up on a player that's 22 or 23 that they're 22 or 23. They may just be a late bloomer. But other than that, I think that this is the way that the game has gone, and we're going to see the continuation of this.
Yeah.
I'm going to go a step further. You know, you're right. I'm the elder statesman, Kirk. I saw Bobby Orr play his first game. I saw Chris Pronger play as a 15-year-old junior B here in Stratford with the Warriors. You know, it's funny because you said in the summertime in the old days these guys had other things to go to. We were joking around before we started recording about how Phil Esposito had to go back to the Sault Ste. Marie and work in the steel mills during the off season. So the biggest thing that has changed is that, like you said, it's a year-round thing now for hockey players. It used to be training camp is when you went in, and that's when you got into shape or started to work out was training camp. Now, players don't need training camp. They're basically, you know, a couple of days of scrimmages or drills, you know, see who has a shot of making the team right away, and then you're bang right into an exhibition schedule. The other factor is in a cap world, you need players on an entry-level contract. Now, the argument is, well, you know, the cap's going up, blah, blah, blah. But you do, because as the cap goes up, contracts go up, and you still have to bring in players on an entry-level contract. I mean, if I were an open cap-friendly up right now, I'd probably see half a dozen teams at least that are right at the cap or somewhere that are over. And without entry-level contracts, they just would not be able to sustain it. So, A, it's a monetary thing because of the cap, and B, the players are so much more prepared now than they were in the 70s or the 80s and maybe even the early 90s. Nowadays, you know, we talked before about Kevin Miller going out and getting a skating coach to work in the off season. Other players are doing that, going to work with power skating coaches or skating coaches of some sort. We have camps like BioSteel, which is going on this week, where there are dozens and dozens of NHL players attending there. As a matter of fact, I heard an interview today with Darnell Nurse, who was there at the BioSteel camp working out. These things go on all summer long. I've been to summer leagues in June and July where NHL players are there playing year round, you know, just to stay in shape, stay in hockey shape, and all those things are contributing factors.
Yeah, I mean, it's a topic we could devote an entire podcast to it, you know. And getting back to your anecdote, here's one funny anecdote. I remember Mario Lemieux talking about how the way he would get in shape before training camp was that he would stop having fries with his club sandwich in August. But you know what I mean? There's great stories over the years. You know, Jerry Cheevers is a wealth of stories about, you know, just how, you know, he would show up, what kind of shape he was in. Happened in this day and age, you know, you it would be just an unbelievable. Like, if you thought the whole, you know, Casey Mittelstadt can't even do one pull up at the combine caused a stir on Twitter, imagine what Jerry Cheever showing up to training camp in this day and age, the way he was back then would. But it's a great discussion. I just don't think we can, you know, like we just have scratched the surface. Just to wrap it up and move on to our next question, because my gosh, we're already at like an hour and 15 minutes on this, and it's awesome. And we're not going to cap it. We're just gonna roll until we get to these questions. But just to wrap it up, I just think that there's good points about the timing. I think the NHL could look at the timelines. They've discussed maybe making the draft, you know, age 19. I don't know how you do that, honestly, legally, and I don't know the feasibility of that. That would be very hard. You'd have to skip a draft 1 year and then yeah, I mean, it's not an easy thing. But maybe what you do is you relook the entry-level contract system, because it is inequitable right now. You know, you've got your CHL timelines versus your USHL timelines. I don't know if there's any possibility that the NHL can look at maybe kicking that CHL timeline down the road a bit. Again, I'm just spitballing here, but there are way more factors in play than we have time to devote. So I'm going to thank Reed and Dom for doing such a good job on bringing up some great points that I did not, and that's why we do this. Now, Dom, I have good news for you. I have a question that I failed to capture, but you were talking about it before we hit record, and so I'm going to throw this out there. You guys can tackle this one initially. It's from James, and he says, how do you envision Don Sweeney's next steps now that he has a solid base of prospects pushing through the system? Sounds like a vote of confidence for drafter Don. At what point does he start moving on from some of the older core players in an effort to collect assets?
Wow. I think we can all phrase all that including how has Don Sweeney fared so far. And that may give an answer as to where he intends to go. Look, I'm a firm believer, and Kirk, you work inside an organization, so you can speak more to it than I can. But a GM comes in, and he sets a vision, and he sets a goal, and heaven forbid he ever sways from his vision and his goal and what he wants to do, because more times than not, it's going to cost him his job. So he has a plan. But here's the thing with Don Sweeney. The general manager always gets the credit, or he always gets the blame, depending on how things go with the team. Don Sweeney has surrounded himself with some very, very smart hockey people. Has there been bad moves? Yeah, you could say there's been one or two bad moves, but it's all part of the learning process that he had to go through. When you bring in guys like Jamie Langenbrunner, Jay Pandolfo, you got Kevin Dean in there, who's, to me, a brilliant hockey mind. Of course, you got Cassidy. He's revamped the amateur scouting staff that it's probably the best we've seen in Boston for a long, long time, if not the best. You know, he's made some changes to the professional scouting group. So he's surrounded himself with smart hockey people to help him through the process. To me, one of the big guys, and I talk about him a lot, but people don't know him, is a fellow by the name of Evan Gould, who was actually brought in by Peter Chiarelli in the legal department. Sweeney moved him up into more of a hockey role. He does some scouting. He does contract negotiations. He's a cap guru. He's a very, very smart when it comes to the cap. So Sweeney relies on him for a lot of other things. You know, so Don Sweeney isn't going to make a decision by himself. He's going to talk to the people he's surrounded himself with. They're going to do what's best for the team, and he's not going to panic. And you know, when the time comes, they've structured contracts like David Backus's, where as he gets older and things change, that they can move him. His no trade clause, you know, becomes more widespread. They've structured the contract where for a team that is struggling financially can take on a big cap hit for small dollars. you know, they aren't just thinking about today. They're thinking 2, 3, 4 years down the road. You see it in the way they draft. You see it in the way they structure contracts. You see it as in a lot of the things they do. So I don't think that they're going to be stuck with contracts they wish they didn't have. I think they've laid out a plan. They're sticking to the plan, and they're not going to sway from it, because in the end, it means somebody's going to lose their job. And like I said, Kirk, you're inside. You see these things. Yeah, I mean, you don't have a cap to deal with, but you're not just thinking this season. You're thinking the season after and the season after that.
100%. 100%. Reed, what you got, baby?
Well, this is a great topic, because I love the job that Don Sweeney has done overall. And people are going to nitpick trades at times, and people, you know, complain about this signing or that signing. But look, when you look at the overall picture, you can't take one move that Don Sweeney has made and said he's had a terrible run because he traded this pick for Zach Rinaldo. No, I'm sorry, it doesn't work that way. You got to look at the body of work. What has he been able to do? What has he been able to amass in Boston? And from the moment that he stepped into the role and traded off, and I still feel like some of the heat that he gets, or maybe a lot of the heat that he gets, is from people who really like Dougie Hamilton and Milan Lucic and didn't want to see them traded. Because from that point on, when you look at what the Bruins have brought in from the drafts and what they've been able to develop and the young players that we've seen now grow into roles on the big club, you can't look at what Don Sweeney's done and say he's done a poor job. Everything that he said he wanted to set out to do, he has done. He changed the culture of the system in Boston. He changed the way that they're drafting and the way that they're developing. And he's gotten scouts who have just the cojones to walk up to the podium and look at a list that the so-called experts will come up with and go, "Eh, these guys are nice, but we've got our guy." Yeah, maybe it's off the conventional board, but we've got a guy that we like and that we're going to go. The likes of Trent Frederick, Zach Sinishin's working his way through in Providence. Urho Vakanainen is going to make his way to Boston sooner rather than later. And Jake DeBrusk is already in the NHL and very, very successful. So Don Sweeney has created a front office that is not scared to believe in themselves. And I think that's the biggest part of it. They're not worried about the noise outside of that front office. That group has bonded together. They have a common vision. They share the vision, and they're moving forward with it. So I think he's done a brilliant job. As for what he does next, there will come a time where there's just too many guys. There's just a glut of prospects. There will be a time where they're going to have to move some of these young players out in package deals. That time isn't right now. It's probably a year or two down the road before we look at that. But he set himself up to be in the right position at the right time to take talent, be able to package it up, and bring more talent in positions that he'll need.
Great. No, that's a great point. I think Ryan Nadeau is certainly a name that is going to be known more and more. He's done great work with Boston, and certainly under the mentorship of Scott Bradley, who's been there for, you know, geez, many, many years. I think, you know, Scott Bradley's been on the staff, you know, going on, you know, over 20 years and going on 30. So, but Ryan Nadeau is, you know, he's a rising star in the scouting world, and just the Bruins scouts work hard. They're out there, and you can question some of the picks they make, but you can't question the effort. You can't question the attention to detail. And I think they've certainly stayed true to their methods and the players that they value and they believe in, and we're seeing it. And, you know, again, you know, it's not necessarily about, you know, hoarding assets. It's just about making the right decisions to help your team. That's what you always try to do. You know, you try to make your team better. And so the old adage of, did you get the best player in the trade? You know, that there's validity to that. Sometimes you might be perceived as giving up a ton of things in a trade, tons of pieces. But if you're getting a proven player who actually comes in and he actually produces and helps you win a championship, go back to 2011. Bruins traded a second-round pick for Chris Kelly. I think that second-round pick ended up being Matt Pumpel, if I'm not mistaken.
No, Shane Prince.
It was, okay, Shane Prince, that's right. But look now back, look back on what happened, right? Chris Kelly comes into the Bruins at the trade deadline. He helps them win a Stanley Cup championship. Shane Prince made the NHL, good kid, good player. Got to know him and his family very well, but he's not in the league anymore, right?
Right.
At the end of the day, that trade made the Bruins better. The Bruins got the better player. Yeah, you know, maybe they gave up a higher value piece. And I was one of the ones leading the charge. Oh, second round pick, you know. But at the end of the day, general managers get paid, and coaches and scouts, their lifeblood is making their team better. And some, you're going to make some unpopular decisions, or you're going to, you know, see things in players that others don't see, and you might be right and you might not. But when you're correct, it's not about focusing on, did you get enough assets for player A? I mean, sometimes, you know, that's going to be in the discussion. Certainly, you know, trades like Joe Thornton and Tyler Seguin are going to come up. And I'm, be honest, guys, I'm surprised we didn't get a question about Tyler Seguin. So I'm going to say be happy for that. It's too late. Don't be running to your keyboards and trying to submit one, guys. But, you know, at the end of the day, I'm with you. We did it. We broke it down, and I think there's a lot to be said for the direction this organization is headed in. They do things their way. They're not worried about what conventional wisdom is, quote-unquote consensus. You have to make tough decisions sometimes, and they may not be very popular, but in the end, you have values, you have convictions, and you have a process. And most people don't understand your process because they're not on the inside. But success should earn you enough leeway and trust to see that process through. I know we got to wrap this up, but we did have one question from Josh from Ottawa. He wanted to go into lineups. We're not going to go into lineups. We've explained that earlier. We had a question about lineups. But, guys, real quick, one young guy to help Josh out, because he did ask, a kid or two impressing the Bruins brassing training camp. We've kind of mentioned a couple of them already, but each of you, one guy that you think would impress Bruins brass enough to potentially get a spot in Boston here coming out of camp for our friend Josh.
I'm going to say Jaxson Nika, and I think Reed's going to agree.
Yep, I got to say Jaxson Nika's the guy that if there's going to be one come up from junior and take a spot, that's the kid that's got all the ability to do it. If something were to happen on the back end, guys, Urho Vakanainen stepping over from Finland, that kid is NHL ready.
Yeah, I'll go with him. I mean, people forget he's been playing, like he had 3 years of pro hockey. You know, SM Liga play before, like the third year was like a half a season, but still he at 15 to 16, he was playing in the SM Liga. So I made a post or a comment about it where he has more pro games than Jakub Zboril does, and he's like 2 years younger than Jakub Zboril, right? And he's got like 70 more pro games or something. It's some ridiculous number. And the SM Liga compares to the AHL. So Reed, I think you're bang on. If the defense becomes an issue, he could, and I think he'll get some games in Boston this year regardless. I just don't think they'll start him in unless their hand is forced. And then I'm going to throw my hat in the ring for JFK. I just think that when you look at how much cajoling they had to do to get him to sign, and he wanted to spend an extra year in college, right? They wanted him to come out, and I just think that the stars will align. Every opportunity he'll get to earn a spot. If he doesn't earn it, he doesn't earn it. But I think they'd have a hard time just sending him down to the minors without giving him a chance to establish himself as a player on this team and make it out of camp and see if he can stick in the NHL. But that's just me, guys. Any last thoughts before we wrap it up?
It's going to be another great year to be a Bruins fan. I hope everybody enjoys. You know, just have a lot of fun with this team. And if anybody is watching the OHL this season, make sure you tune into the Hamilton Bulldogs home games. You'll hear a familiar voice on the air. And to my other two amigos, we may not get a chance to do this again until next summer, guys. But, you know, my phone's always around. And love hearing from you guys.
Yeah, ditto. I just want to throw something personal in if I can. I didn't tell you guys beforehand because you probably would have said, let's not do this tonight, Dom. But, you know, I needed this as much as people who want to listen to you know, bring some sort of calmness into life. But Tuesday night, I lost two close people to a terrible car accident. And 5 minutes later, got a phone call from a friend who, mutual friend, whose 17-year-old daughter, sorry guys, 17-year-old daughter had committed suicide. And as someone who suffers greatly from depression, I'm urging anybody out there, if you need to talk to somebody, please, please, please do it. There are people that are out there that are willing to help you. And I'm just going to leave it at that, guys.
Wow. Okay. Well, I'm really sorry to hear about that, Dom. And there you go. I mean, I don't think there's much more that needs to be said than that, other than, you know, every day is a gift. Love the people you're with. Let them know how much you care about them. And, you know, we care about you guys. We do this out of love for the game. Appreciate the traffic on the blog. Appreciate the interaction. Sometimes, I'll be honest, it doesn't seem like we don't get much feedback. But you know what? That's not what we do this. We're not here to get feedback. We just do it because we love the sport. We love the team. And we love to bring our thoughts to you. So, Dom, sincerest condolences to your friends that have lost their lives and the young lady there. Boy, no words. So on that note, you know, again, thank you all for providing the questions. We hope that the answers were informative for you. I wish my three amigos the absolute best, as they so aptly sang in the Ballad of the Three Amigos, one for each other, all for one. The three amigos are we. So on that note, take care of yourselves. Thank you for listening. Have a great hockey season, and we will try to catch you at some point. You never know. But this is Kirk for Dom, for Reed, signing off. The three amigos. We'll catch you on the flip side. Cheers.
Please allow me to adjust my pants so that I may dance the good time dance and put the onlookers and innocent bystanders into a trance. Give the sea so the swine will marry and propagate lies. Tough luck for elected officials, the beast you see got 50 eyes. Bring it on home, spread the wealth, play it cool, the hand's been dealt. Now all the odds are in our favor, save the victory speeches for later. Streets on fire, the mob.